Hello, everyone. Before we start today's podcast, some exciting news for you. You can experience the Inside Politics podcast live in Dublin on May 16th when Hugh Linehan, Jennifer Bray and I will be joined by Cliff Young of Ipsos, one of America's top pollsters, to talk about the US election, our own local and European elections and much more. It's a breakfast event kicking off at 8 a.m. in Trinity College. If you'd like to attend, you can get tickets at irishtimes.com/events. That's irishtimes.com/events. I hope we see lots of you there.
It's Wednesday, October the 14th, and you're very welcome to the Inside Politics podcast from the Irish Times. I'm Hugh Linehan. It is the day after Pascal Donoghue and Michael McGrath delivered the first budget of this coalition government, and it was a budget like no other, with billions of euro being pumped into the economy to mitigate the effects of the COVID-19 pandemic. In a little while, we're going to be hearing from Irish Times columnist David McWilliams, but first, our political editor, Pat Leahy, is here. Pat, you were writing before the budget yesterday about budgets passed and how they had a different types of character. The word unprecedented is grossly overused these days, but I haven't seen anything like that one before.
It's an unprecedentedly correct use of the word unprecedented, Hugh.
Well, thank God for that. So tell us, what was it like?
I've covered budgets since the early to mid 2000s. And this was certainly unlike anything we've had before, both in form and in content, and also in the way that the day unfolded. You're right, I was reminiscing in the paper on the yesterday morning about how budget days of old used to go. And there's a couple of different types, but when I arrived in, they were very much Celtic Tiger budgets. And, you know, Leinster House was absolutely packed with people who came in for the day. The bars were full all day. The whole thing was great fun anyway. But and of course, lots of money was given away. And then there were the austerity budgets that came after that, and they were much less fun. Although there was still a fair bit of drinking, if I recall correctly. Well, there was no drinking yesterday, and there wasn't a whole heap of fun either. The whole thing took place in the Convention Centre, as people will have seen, which is a deeply, deeply unatmospheric place for parliamentary set pieces. My heart went out to Piers Doherty, who has one of the most difficult jobs in the parliamentary calendar, is to reply to the budget speeches. And because, of course, you know, you only know what you're replying to pretty shortly before you get on your feet, albeit that nowadays many of the details tend to be leaked in the days beforehand. But Piers Doherty got up and was having a proper cut off the government and criticising the budget, and I was several tiers above him up in the gods of the Convention Centre, and all I could think of was, like, what's he getting so excited about down there? What's that small man down there so far away trying to get so excited about, as he, you know, faced the stage? Because instead of facing your political opponents, you're facing the stage where a somewhat nonplussed Ciarán Cúrla sits up on a raised platform, trying to look interested in what's going on. So the form of the day and the way the day unfolded was was unlike anything we've seen before, and really whatever the opposite of compelling is. And then I suppose the content of the budget itself people will have seen, which was an enormous giveaway, as had been flagged before. In a way, this is a continuation of policy. It's certainly the first budget that we have to address the pandemic. But many of the measures that have been introduced, both by the last government in its final phase and by this government, the budget was simply a continuation of them. So things like, you know, huge supports for business, for workers, deficit spending right across government departments, especially in departments of health and social welfare of course, but also in places like education, arts, transport, communications, all across the various outlets of government, we're seeing huge deficit spending. But that was very much a continuation of existing policies, to the extent that our headline this morning in the top of our lead story this morning talks about the government borrowing 40 billion euros, which will to deal with the effects of the pandemic and to support the economy during the pandemic. But that is made up of 20 billion borrowing for next year, which was revealed in yesterday's budget. But it's also made up of the 20 billion euros that's been borrowed this year.
I was reading your opinion piece about this morning in this morning's Irish Times. It brought to mind Pascal's Wager, particularly given the name of our current Minister for Finance. Our readers are well read enough to know that Blaise Pascal was a 17th century French philosopher who made a rational argument for belief in God, because you're going to have two choices. And if you choose to believe in God when you die, well, then the pearly gates will be open and the red carpet will be rolled out for you. If you choose to believe in God and you die and there's no God and there's just the empty void, well, you know, you didn't lose anything, essentially. And isn't the same thing true to some extent of Pascal Donohue's wager here? Even if the pandemic turns out to be worse than presumed and the world economy tanks and various things happen, there is still no percentage in doing anything other than throwing the kitchen sink at the economy at this moment in time.
Yeah, I think that's a pretty good analogy, to be honest. I mean, to a certain extent, this is a gamble. It's a gamble that things improve economically next year. That depends on the public health situation improving, on the hope of a vaccine, or perhaps just better and more effective treatments that mean that the fear of infection is considerably diminished, and the seriousness of infection for many people could be diminished, thus allowing a greater opening up of the economy. But the framers of this budget, no more than any of the rest of us, don't know if that's going to happen. People hope that there will be a vaccine, that there will be better treatments, that there will be the economic opening up that would entail. But they don't know it for certain. But I suppose all you can do in these circumstances is, you know, play the game that's in front of you. It is necessary to support the economy. The alternative is a massive contraction, a massive and sudden contraction of the economy, such as we saw in the period of 2008 and 2009, when it wasn't open to the government to undertake this huge borrowing to support economic activity. So the economy will be kept chugging along, even at a diminished state, by the huge borrowing. That will protect businesses and livelihoods to a certain degree, in the hope that when the circumstances are there for an economic recovery, that happens very rapidly in public finances and economic activity is rebuilt at a substantial level. But for now, all the government can do, it has decided, is to borrow these vast sums to take the place, to allow its subventions and public spending to take the place of private sector economic activity that has receded. In a way, it's classic Keynesianism in that regard. But of course, Keynesianism, there's another side to it as well. It requires the state to retreat once private sector economic activity ramps up again. And maybe that's something we'll talk about in due course.
There's also built into it necessarily, isn't there, far more contingency than you would normally get in a budget which sets out the plans, fiscal plans for the years ahead. So there's a large fund which may or may not be used depending on how all this pans out, and major questions about things like the future of the pandemic unemployment payment are still, you know, left up in the air for review again in February or March and whenever they fall due.
I think a certain amount of that is, you know, both necessary and prudent, because simply, you know, given the unpredictability of the public health circumstances in which we find ourselves, and therefore the unpredictability of the economic conditions that that are likely to prevail next year, that that the government has built in buffers into its spending plans. So in the 8.5 billion euros that they estimate it's going to cost to tackle the pandemic next year, there's 2 billion of a contingency fund built into that. So that money is provided for, borrowed, voted for by the Dáil, but it may not be used. And if you look at, you know, simply the example of this year in terms of how bad the government expected the hit to be on the public finances. I mean, in April, when the government set out its fiscal statement that goes to the EU in April, what we used to call the spring statement, it was forecasting, you know, a deficit of 10% of output in cash terms, up to a deficit of up to 30 billion. Now, there was a rebound in the economy over the summer with the opening up. Tax has performed an awful lot better than expected, corporation tax and income tax. And the multinational sector, particularly in health and IT, has been chugging along without any discernible ill effects from the pandemic. So that has closed the deficit by 10 billion euros. So the deficit for this year will not be 30 billion euros, it'll be 20 billion euros. So you can see the sort of volatility and unpredictability that simply go with the current public health and economic circumstances. So I think, you know, the government will have to keep resources free and will have to maintain a sort of flexibility, not just in its fiscal stance, but in the sort of measures that it might be forced to take next year.
I think you were arguing in this morning's Irish Times that this moment, this first budget, represents really a point at which this still relatively new government comes together and exhibits a level of cohesion that hasn't necessarily done heretofore. And I suppose that's embodied, isn't it, in these two politicians, Pascal Donoghue and Michael McGrath, who seem to have a relatively decent working relationship, don't seem unalike, perhaps, in personality type, and seem both more emollient and better at getting on with each other than some of their colleagues, including their respective party leaders.
Yes, that is true. Now, I will say that Pascal Donoghue and Michael McGrath have never been the problem. You know, we're never likely to be the problem in terms of parties getting on with each other in this coalition. In fact, their relationship with one another, not just over recent years, when, of course, Fianna Fáil were facilitating the Fine Gael government through confidence and supply, and Michael McGrath was working closely with Pascal Donoghue on previous budgets, but also in the period between the general election and the formation of this government. I think the relationship between the two men was very important to that government being formed in the first place. So I never viewed them as the difficulty between the parties. The difficulty has been at a higher and a lower level between Micheál Martin and Leo Varadkar, and also at a lower level of the parties. But I think it is true that the government is displaying a coming together, and typically with coalition governments, although we haven't seen a coalition government like this before, but what you expect with coalition governments is they have a tricky bedding in process as everybody gets used to the new arrangements, as it becomes apparent to everybody involved that after a long time of being rivals, now they're on the one team, more or less. And often you find that the first budget that a coalition government produces is an important staging point in the coming together of the parties. And that's the sort of process that I think is underway at the moment. And I think visibly so yesterday. Now, it is still the case, I was writing a couple of days ago, that, you know, Fianna Fáil still gives out about Fine Gael still gives out about Fianna Fáil, Green Party give out about both of them, and they give out about the Green Party, but less so than they were a month, 2 months, 3 months ago. And I think that we're seeing this process taking place, and I think we saw it publicly yesterday.
Can I ask you then just about one incident, which probably was not that important, really. But it did strike me that back in the 1990s, I think Phil Hogan lost his job for accidentally leaking some details of a budget before it had actually been released. Yesterday, Leo Varadkar was tweeting details which had not yet been announced officially to the Dáil. It's probably, you know, times have changed. The way the communication floats around the place or zips around the place is different now. But in a way, it was another kind of Varadkar as cheeky pup moment, wasn't it?
Well, you can't expect me, given our coverage of recent days, to be giving out about budget leaks.
No, but that's your job, you know, that's fine.
Look, there was a little bit of commentary about this around yesterday. I think given the level, and actually the Ciarán Cóirlí referenced it at the beginning of his speech when warning TDs that officially the budget speeches and documents which are provided for the TDs when the Minister for Finance and then the Minister for Public Expenditure begin their speeches, the details of those speeches are embargoed until such time as the Minister has actually said the words. The Ciarán Cóirlí pointed this out to everybody. He said, lest there be any danger that the national media wouldn't already have reported these. So I think that budgets have changed since the days when, you know, they were guarded like the third secret of Fatima, and it was a hanging offence if anyone released any details of them in advance. I mean, as readers of our paper and others will have seen in recent days, most of the details were leaked in advance. I, for one, think this is a positive development.
Of course you do. Now, of course, this is a three-way coalition. Sort of two-part question to you. One, can the Greens be happy with their fingerprints on this particular budget? And two, are the green elements the ones that might be the ones that throw up the traditional potholes that sometimes emerge in a budget in the days after a budget when there is adverse reaction to things like, for example, the change in the way that motor vehicles are taxed?
There was a fair bit of pushback from rural TDs last night in the Dáil about precisely this, the tax on motor vehicles, etc. But is it turning into a full-scale detonate underneath your arse budget landmine to the extent that you're scrambling to reverse those measures in the finance bill? I don't think so. I don't see the signs of that yet. Never mind what I think about the Green input into the government. Look at what the Greens themselves were saying. So people like Francis Duffy, who was an opponent of entering government, was this morning sending out a series of tweets and statements pointing out not just the successes that the Green Party had in green-tinged policies, environmental policies and climate action policies and so forth in this government, but also, and this is crucial for a wing of the Green Party, but also he was praising the Greens' input in this budget in terms of social justice measures, and he was looking especially at housing in that regard. So, you know, one of the questions that we would have had in advance of this government, given those elements of, if not quite internal opposition, then certainly internal questioning within the Green Party, the minority that voted against entry into government and warned of its consequences, the Just Transition Greens and that element within the party, was there any danger of the Green TD or two going overboard and voting against or abstaining on budget resolutions last night? There was no sign of that. The Greens were rock solid. I think the party collectively has made its decision that it enters government. And if you're going to do that, the only way to do it is to take the rough with the smooth. You can't take the bits that you like and don't like. You negotiate your corner and you accept the outcome of those negotiations. backing or at least tolerating those bits of it that you may not be entirely happy with, but which you view as an acceptable trade-off as long as it means you get your parts or are the bulk of your core policies implemented. And that's, I think, what we're seeing happening with the Greens at the moment. That's not to say that there won't be individual problems with individual policies in the future, but I think, you know, the prospect of walkouts, defections, a split in the party on budgetary matters, it seems kind of remote this morning.
Just a reminder to our listeners again that you can sign up for a subscription to the Irish Times at irishtimes.com/inside. And if you use that particular address, irishtimes.com/inside, they will know we sent you there, which helps us in our efforts to keep making this podcast just a little bit better. And if you haven't done so already, we'd be delighted if you'd consider signing up now. Now, I did talk last night to our columnist, the economist David McWilliams, about this year's budget, and this is what he had to say. David, I always think, probably wrongly, that economists feel about budgets the way the rest of the human race feels about things like big sporting occasions or exciting movie releases or music festivals. Do you feel that way about budgets?
This is our electric picnic, don't you know it? This is it. This is the electric picnic. This is Slane. This is Fela all rolled into one, and I'm showing my age.
That's a pretty sad version now. Having listened to Pascal Donoghue followed by Michael McGrath today, that was one long gig.
That was a very long gig. There's a couple of very dull guitar solos. Drummers should never do drum solos as well. We know that. And who's Cozy Powell, though? Is it Pascal or the other lad?
I think we may be extending this metaphor too long. I mean, I understand you're not a great fan of kind of picking budgets apart or analysing budgets or that kind of stuff. But, I mean, this is quite a significant one.
This is a significant one. And I think we've got to stand back and we've got to give credit. You know, what I've always felt the most important thing about budgets or any big sort of economic statement, Hugh, is whether or not the minister or whoever the policymaker is answers the question, what is going on here? Okay, right? And it sounds very straightforward, but you'd be amazed the amount of politicians who don't get the what is going on here question. The what is going on here question, I think Pascal Donoghue gets, which is the following, Hugh. He is making, or the Department of Finance, or the government, depend on how broad you want to go, are making decisions in a time of radical uncertainty, okay? And there's a big difference between risk and uncertainty. Risk is when you think, you know what, I'll look at the odds, Liverpool, Man United, and I'll figure out that I'm taking a risk, but I can measure that risk. Uncertainty is what we're in now. We've no idea, actually, what's going to happen. And the reason you've no idea what's going to happen is everything is governed by the progression of the pandemic and the way we choose to react to it. So this is why I've decided a while ago to say this isn't really a recession or a depression. It's this idea of a pandemic. And the reason it is the exit strategy, which normally in economics is a fairly predictable risk assessment, is now shrouded with this profound uncertainty. So consequently, the budget seems to me to be a very good stab at saying, look, we're not too sure how long this is going to go on. We have taken the decision to stand down large parts of the private sector, particularly you were mentioning festivals and gigs. It's nice to see that there's some relief for the live music side of things. But we know the health service is going to be under pressure. We know the welfare service is going to be under pressure. We know we've got to keep going on with the housing initiative, etc. So it seems to me, Hugh, to stand back, that picking a figure close to 20 billion, which is what they've done as an extra injection to the economy, seems to me to be the right thing to do. I was worried that they would actually get bullied by the, what I would call the fiscal jihadis in the Department of Finance, who keep going on about we have to pay the money back, we have to pay the money back. We actually don't have to pay the money back. This is one of the great alchemies of the place we're in economically. So let's stand back and say they've done one big thing right. They've answered the question, what is going on? They have then understood that they're making decisions in times of radical uncertainty, and they've thrown the net reasonably wide in order to try and compensate for what has happened, which is the state has stood down large parts of the private sector. And I think they've done quite a good job.
Now, I want to come back in a minute to the whole why we don't have to pay the money back, which is obviously very interesting. But before I do that, just that you were quite critical of Pascal Donohue a few weeks ago or a month or two ago. You seemed to feel that he had been captured by the fiscal jihadis in the Department of Finance. Do you think he's escaped from them then?
Well, I'm glad to see he was listening to our discussion in the podcast. No, I think he has. I think he has. I think that, well, basically, when a state borrows money at very low rates of interest, there tends to be a cacophony of apocalyptic warnings of saying, well, what will happen when the rate of interest goes to 5% or 10%? This is the usual thing. And then you've got to realize that the rate of interest, which is very important in this context when you're borrowing a lot, it doesn't go up on its own. This is the rate of interest is the consequence of something else, okay? And it's the consequence of either extremely buoyant economic growth or dramatically increased rates of inflation or a combination of both. So then you've got to look at, is it likely over the next 20 years that, and I'm talking about 20 years, that the European Union, run by the European Central Bank, will experience 1950s, 1960s levels of economic growth, which you got in Italy and Germany and France, which were above 6 or 7% per year. That's absolutely not going to happen. So your idea that interest rates will rise to 6 or 7% has to be predicated on a growth rate that nobody thinks is going to happen. So the way in which we should look at this, we are now in a period of very low interest rates for a long time. And the reason is the following. It's the European Union, and particularly Germany and Italy, to a lesser degree France, are very old countries. And old countries, by definition, save a lot. It's called the life cycle hypothesis in inflation, that basically you spend a hell of a lot of money at certain stages in your life, and you save as you get older. And older people save, and that's why older societies tend to have lower growth rates, because they don't have the same need for investment or consumption. So taking that together, it strikes me that the fiscal jihadis were locked somewhere in their heads in the late 1980s in Ireland, where there were these set to battles between Gareth Fitzgerald and Alan Jukes and Charlie Haughey. Those days are gone. They were like kind of the teething process getting to where we're getting now. So my own sense is I'm delighted that Pascal Donohue has escaped the clutches of the fiscal jihadis, not least because that's the right thing to do. And the fiscal jihadis or extremists or whatever you want to call them, vigilantes, are simply generals fighting the last war.
But is Pascal Donohue not really just joining what I suppose is the new orthodoxy, the new post-austerity, anti-austerity orthodoxy? I mean, you hear people like Steve Mnuchin in the States clearly want to spend a lot more money if they were let by Congress. The head of the Fed in the States want to do it. You can see it with the ECB as well. Everybody's saying now, let's inject more money into these economies to keep them alive.
Look, that's what I was saying to you months ago. There's nothing radical at all, Hugh, about what I'm saying. There's never anything radical about what I say, okay? It's always kind of the new orthodoxy in many ways. Maybe I just spotted this quicker than other people, that in actual fact we had turned a corner and we were into a new sort of a dispensation. You know, economics is like rock and roll. It changes. There are no hard and fast rules or ways of playing gigs or whatever. It moves with the times, and the times have changed. It's what Keynes said, you know. He said, you know, when he was asked why he changed his mind, he said something very simple. He says, when the facts change, I change my mind. What do you do, sir? And I think that economics is as cognizant of what's going on in the world as any other pursuit. But the problem is that certain ideologues in economics think that these hard and fast rules are immutable, like the rules of physics. If we're talking about physics, we could say, well, these are hard and fast rules and they're actually applicable all the time. You know, and, you know, if you change them, you change the whole equation. Economics is not like that. It's a much softer science, as we know.
Are there dangers in there, though, if you step down just from that very macro helicopter view? And if you go back a few months, I think the argument for, you know, just helicopter lift dropping money onto the economy to keep the economy going, that argument was strongly made, and I think it was well taken. You shouldn't be faffing around with clerical details or things like that. But now we're into kind of the second phase of this. So there are these very, very large sums of money being announced in today's budget. Most of the additional money breaks down either into specific pandemic supports to keep keep people from drowning over the next few months while we hopefully get to the end of this thing as next year winds on. And the other one is injecting money into the economy in the shape of capital investment in infrastructure. Now, we do know in Ireland that particularly with the second of those, we're well capable of making a dog's dinner of it, whether it be because of political cronyism or ineptitude or children's hospitals that cost three times as much as they should and the same with lots of other things. You know, that can have a sort of a negative impact on an economy as well, can't it?
Yeah, it can. It also, I think it also can have a very negative impact on sentiment if people feel that, you know, their money is being blithely wasted. The Children's Hospital, I think, really angered many, many people because of the way in which the budget seemed to be a movable feast. But that's an accounting issue. And what I can't understand, Hugh, and I maybe some of the listeners of the podcast can put me straight in this, is I can't understand how let's say you're building a hospital and you come up with a budget of a billion. I don't understand how that can move and be allowed to move in the context. It would not happen to the same degree in the private sector. That is something we do know. There needs to be a moment where the state can walk away from these budgets, which are not only not hard, but which seem to have a certain amount of inflation in them. But I wouldn't sidetracked going down that particular route as, you know, if we spend the money, will it be spent wisely? That's another discussion. And that, I think, is all about how you manage projects and project management and supply chain management and all that sort of stuff. What I think is that what would have been disastrous, Hugh, and the first thing I want to say is this may not be the end of the social spending. What we are doing is we are going down the route of social democracy on the sly, right? That's actually what's happening, that the levels of government spending that are necessary to bring this economy to the public service delivery of Northwestern Europe is probably about 3 or 4% of GDP higher every year than where it is now. So that's actually what's happening in a sort of an unusual way. And the thing is that these expenditures are already reversed. That's what you notice in all democracies, is it's very, very hard to take money away from people once you've given it to them. So I think what we're moving is into over the next 10 years, kicking off today, is a more Dutch or Germanic sort of feel to the place in terms of the balance between government spending, taxes, etc. So in a way, it's a sort of reversal of maybe 20 years of Irish economic policy. So it's quite interesting.
So it's the end of McCreevyism and a move to something else.
Yeah, it's a move to something else. And again, as I say, the reason it is because the facts have changed, the ground has shifted, and the population demands something else. And I've always said that, you know, and this is where if you look at what's happening in the UK seemed to have become sort of caught between being hardline on the fiscal side and demanding the balancing their budgets, but also locking down on the private sector side. You can't balance budgets in a pandemic. This is a tautology.
But what happens then when we get to budget 2022 next October, or maybe, you know, the one the year after, and we have hopefully first partially and then completely emerged from this thing? Who knows? There might even be an electric picnic next year. We certainly hope to be an electric picnic the year afterwards, and all around the economy is picking up and there's all that kind of stuff. We've invested, we've managed to build a few decent schools and put a bit more decent infrastructure in. We want to keep doing that. We also want to keep a better standard of healthcare, better standard of education for our kids. We've got a low tax base, and we're going to have to change that if we're going to deliver those things, because we're not going to borrow for that for till kingdom come.
Well, I think actually large deficits are here for quite some time. I don't think there'll be any austerity budgets introduced because I don't think they'll be necessary. And again, we come back to, you know, austerity budgets don't happen on their own. They happen if and when the central bank of Europe, in this case, or the central bank, it would have been the case in Ireland many years ago, but the European Central Bank, decide that you're not going to get any more money cheaply, which is exactly what they decided for Ireland in 2010. And they decided that for Greece. It was an actually explicit decision, right? We are lucky in a way that the rest of Northwestern Europe shares the same pandemic situation as ours. So it's not really conceivable in my playbook that the ECB will tighten the reins quickly, because if you look at the sort of political, demographic, and social pressures on the continent, Hugh, they are much more demanding of looser monetary policy for quite some time. So that answers the, you know, the near term, and I'm talking the near term, the next 3 or 4 years, okay? Looking at further, I think you're absolutely right. I think we will have to broaden our tax base. That demands parties of the left appreciate that property tax is a left-wing policy. Amazingly, in Ireland, the parties of the left are against property tax. They're the only left-wing parties, I believe, in the entire world that is against a wealth tax. Most people's wealth being property, and it's actually the single biggest driver of wealth inequality in Ireland is property. So I would say that has to change. I would think that Sinn Féin have talked about tightening up on some multinational loopholes. I think that will become the norm over the course of the next while. And I suspect then that the obsession and the right obsession will be to make sure that taxes on income don't rise too dramatically. So you got to get, as you said, your taxes somewhere else. So you get them on capital and on wealth. And I don't see a problem with that. I think these are natural processes. In the same way, I was quite confident about the helicopter money 6 months ago. I think that these big trends speak of changes in the world. You see them all over the place. You see them in the United States. You see them in mainland Europe. This is the way we're going. This is the direction of travel here.
And last question, because I know I'm going to be talking to Pat Leahy after I talk to you. And I know any time I talk to Pat about this, Pat gets this very serious look in his face at one point, and I can tell that he is channeling voices from around Merrion Street somewhere. People are talking to him into his ear and they're saying, this is all very well, and yes, it has to be done, and it's an emergency situation, but you know this is going to have to be paid back, you know, and at some point we're going to have to draw on our horns, and we're going to do that, and that's just the reality of the way fiscal things are. So tell me why the people who are telling him that are wrong and why we don't have to pay it back.
Tell Pat that if you come out in this country with ideas that are ahead of the game, okay, you go through three phases, okay? Your first phase is open ridicule, where the insiders tap their nose and say, see that guy? He's a bit of a radical. And then the second phase you go through is what I would call the violent opposition phase, which is where they actually pay people to do a hatchet job on you because your ideas are gaining currency, okay? And then the third phase is the phase that we are now in with the fiscal spending, which is the everybody pretends they were on your side all the time phase, okay? So tell Pat to take a deep breath and realize that the idea that we will have some sort of 1980s style austerity, early 2010 style austerity is, again, it's like generals fighting the last war. And that's actually what happens, is that when your collective memory is stuck in a traumatic period, you feel that at every stage, that period is just on the cusp of re-entering your consciousness. But in actual fact, that's not how economics works. Economics works in a sort of a extraordinary way of having no real memory. It tends to clear its desks and start again. And you see that all the time in various big shifts, that what was gospel in, for example, the 1970s, became pariah in the 1980s. The 1980s ideas became the ideas that most people thought were right until 2008. Now they are pariah ideas, and austerity, needless austerity is what we're talking about, is one of those. When you have a central bank which has decided to reduce interest rates to zero, fiscal policy and monetary policy become one and the same thing. And those jihadis remain what they are, extremists that should be regarded as extremists.
David, thanks very much for joining us.
Cheers, Hugh.
So, Pat, who are these jihadis? Are they still around? It seems to me that the new orthodoxy seems to be almost 100% on the Keynesian model now. Although it is interesting, in the United Kingdom, you can see some pushback against Rishi Sunak and some attempt to recalibrate the Tory party. And equally in the United States, you can also see the fact that the Republicans are pushing back against the stimulus bill. So not everybody's on the same side. But here in Ireland, I have yet to hear a criticism of this fiscal approach.
Yeah, I think David, the jihadi hunter of Dalkey Quarry, is in danger of setting up a straw man there. Nobody is arguing, I think, that we shouldn't be engaged in deficit spending now. Even non-clairvoyant economists, and I sometimes wonder if one of the criticisms I would reluctantly make of David is that sometimes he's so far ahead of the game that he may be decades ahead of the game, and that the country will actually have to, by the time his advice comes around to be undoubtedly proven to be correct, or and his analysis proven to be true, that things may have moved on so much that that we're all old and grey. But look, joshing aside, I don't think that there is. I don't think there's any substantial criticism of deficit spending at the moment, given the circumstances in which we find ourselves. But let's not pretend that we're not deficit spending either. We're borrowing $20 billion this year, $20 billion next year. That will bring our national debt to $240 billion. Now, we could, of course, if repayments and refinancing of that, which is well into the future, becomes... if that becomes undoable for the government of the day, they could take the advice of the people who will undoubtedly, as they were 10 years ago, advising the state to renege on its debts and start from scratch. But now, just as then, the state would then have to face up to the need to balance its books immediately until such time as it persuaded financial markets to lend to it again. The government will not do that unless it is faced with a catastrophic situation. And that catastrophic situation is not at all inevitable. In fact, I guess it's unlikely. But what is likely is that we won't, and I think probably certain, is that we won't be able to borrow 20 billion euros every year indefinitely. And what that means is that the non-pandemic bits of this massive budgetary extension that we saw yesterday, so if you take the Department of Health as an example, it got an extra 4 billion yesterday, bringing its total annual budget to somewhere around 21 billion for next year. Now, of that extra 4 billion that the Department of Health was allocated yesterday, 2 billion will be for pandemic spending, 2 billion for a general expansion of services. Now, let's all hope that the pandemic, that a vaccine arrives and the pandemic recedes maybe next year. That still means that our health service is going to be, everything else being equal, 2 billion more expensive. We won't be able to borrow on an ongoing basis for that. We will have to meet more or less over the economic cycle or over the lifetime of a government. We will have to pay for current expenditure with tax receipts that the government collects. Borrowing in the short term isn't a problem, but as long as your creditworthiness remains and ours does, borrowing... in the long term for capital expenditure isn't a problem. It's economically and politically wise. But borrowing large sums indefinitely to meet current expenditure is, in my view, not something that is likely to be possible. And therefore, there does come a point when the non-pandemic bits of this, of all this increased spending, will have to be paid for either by economic growth, and that's what people in government hope for, or if not, by tax increases and spending cuts. Ultimately, it'll probably be better by a combination of all three. But the idea, and I'm sure this isn't what David is suggesting, the idea that we simply borrow 20 billion every year to meet current bills is, I'm afraid, not one that is likely to be sustainable.
No, I think what David is suggesting, and I'd be interested in your political take on this, is that there is an inevitable move to the left in many Western societies, including in Ireland, a return or perhaps a move to a new form of social democratic model. And that, and I think he did make this point, and that will have to be paid for out of taxation within the country itself to pay for the kind of things you're talking about, an enhanced health service, better social provisions of one sort or another, childcare, et cetera, that those will have to be paid, and that that will mean that Ireland will need to shift to a more high tax economy than it has been for the last 30 or 40 years.
I couldn't agree more. I've been making this point for months that the consequences of the pandemic will be a bigger state, and a bigger state will have to be paid for. The previous point I was making is that if you have a bigger state, then you have to pay for that with a combination of more taxes and economic growth. And if the state gets too big, then you have to roll back on services. That tends to be politically very difficult. And I think that this is where, and I think I referred to it in the paper this morning, as the possibility that the coalition is setting a political trap for itself, because in the second half of this government, assuming and hoping that the pandemic recedes and the state, that we end up with a state that is bigger, but an economy that may be smaller, or at least not big enough to sustain the state at the size that we want it to be, that is going to require greater, higher levels of taxation. That will not be politically popular. And whatever the government does to close the gap between current expenditure and current revenues will be characterised by the opposition, by Sinn Féin in particular, as austerity. And that, I think, is a medium-term political difficulty that may be facing this administration in the second half of its life. And when I put this yesterday to a couple of senior people in government, their response essentially was, yeah, but we'll cross this bridge when we get to it.
So finally then, am I naive? And the answer to that question is always yes, by the way. But am I naive in thinking that, I think there was an announcement yesterday of some form of commission slash review into taxation and social provision? If that's set up, might that have more, whatever about more teeth, might it be more meaningful than those things sometimes are?
Possibly, yes, depending on the economic circumstances in which its report eventually arrives. I actually put the question specifically on the record to Pascal Donoghue in a video interview that's that listeners can probably find on the website. And he said, yes, you know, we know this. That's why difficult decisions will be down the line. And when a politician starts talking about difficult decisions, you know that the politics is likely to deteriorate for him or her. But that's, I think, in the second half of this government. And while there is a view in government that that and the difficult politics that come with it is inevitable, I suppose it's understandable that they're playing the pandemic in front of them for now.
Indeed. Pat, thanks for joining us today. Thanks also to David McWilliams for joining us earlier, also to our producer Declan Conlon and our engineer JJ Vernon. You can get in touch with us by mailing us at politicspodcast@irishtimes.com. We're always delighted to hear from you. Until the next time, thanks very much indeed for listening.